Now, a child's first day of school can be an anxious time, but it can also be an exciting and even joyous time full of hope and potential and those giant new hats and backpacks. How well they're going to go at school, though, will be hugely affected by their families. Children with parents who are wealthier and have stayed at school longer tend to do better. But if you're not in that basket, should you despair? Professor Adrian Piccoli says there are things all parents can do to help their children love learning. His parents didn't study beyond high school, but now he's the director of the Gonski Institute for Education and a former New South Wales Education Minister. His new book's called 12 Ways Your Child Can Get the Best Out of School. Professor Piccoli, welcome to Life Matters.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here.
Now, you've no doubt met many educators, but you say one of the greatest teachers you ever met was your mum. What was her role in your schooling?
My mother's influence on me was profound, as I think most mothers are. And I think when I think about what I've experienced in education over the last 8 years in my involvement in public policy, et cetera, reminded me of the values around education that my mother instilled in me. As I saw the research and listened to experts talk about education, she reminded me of what my mother did when I myself was at school and as a young child.
And really, her educational progress was a little thwarted, wasn't it?
Yeah, she loved school. She was a great creative writer, and she really wanted to go on and get a teacher's college at Goulburn at the time. And even her English teacher came to visit my grandparents on their little farm just outside of Griffith in Western New South Wales and said, hey, Nevis is really great at school she should go on and... But, you know, in those days in the 50s and the 60s, it wasn't really nice girls, as my grandfather said, stayed home and married nice boys, nice farmers. And that's what she did. And she's always regretted that. But she always made sure that her children absolutely took every opportunity throughout their education. And that's what we've generally done.
And you talk a lot in your book about it not being so much about the formal educational modelling, but about the informal ways that your parents relate to education that might have an impact on a child. Tell us a bit more about that.
I talk a lot about the first 5 years before children start school. It's really setting up that foundation of literacy, particularly, and numeracy. So, but also the value that children have and their appreciation of education before they even start the first year at school. And a lot of that is influenced by parents. So are we surprised that our children support the same football team or sporting team that we as parents do? Of course, because they love us, they look up to us, they want to do the things that we do, same values that we value. And the same applies in education. When you speak positively about school or about education, even if you didn't have a great experience yourself, as my mother did, or a long experience, if you speak positively, your children are going to be much more positively inclined towards school, the value of it. But also, they will inherit from you a love of reading, a love of knowledge. It's important to have books around, them to see you reading, and them to see you valuing education as well.
That's a tricky territory, though, isn't it, for some parents who might not have grown up in a house with many books themselves and might be straitened financially as well as with that background of disadvantage to have the books and magazines and newspapers around and model that love of reading and of learning. What are your thoughts for them?
That is a challenge because again, not all parents are great readers themselves. And now that poses a significant challenge. And I guess what is, as you said in the introduction, parents who've gone on to further education or higher education tend to be wealthier. Their children, and I've got to say, on average, tend to do better. That's not because they are wealthier or because they went to university or got a trade. That's because of the things that they do. So they tend to talk more positively about education, use more words and more complex language in front of their children. Those are the kinds of things, and their children kind of have different experience, maybe more complex experiences, which helps their development. But again, that's not something that can't be replicated by anybody. So again, my parents' own experience, not long experiences at school, but they did model all of those positive things that then influenced myself and my brothers and sisters towards that really positive view about education and how important it was.
But I guess you've got to have a certain sense of positivity about education yourself, don't you, to be able to go, hey, this is a fun problem to solve together, or let's practice our writing, or look at that sign over there instead of go and watch a screen for a while.
Well, it's screens are another distraction. Yeah, but that's right. So it's about giving as much of an opportunity to your children as possible, and you know, parents have varieties of ability to do that, particularly around time. You know, we're all a bit time constrained, but whatever you can do is going to be helpful. And the purpose of this book really is, how do you make sure that relationship works well? It's three-way. It's schools, your child, and you as a parent or a carer. How do you make sure that relationship is really positive and nurturing for your child? I think the question a lot of parents ask themselves is, how can I help? How can I help? Sometimes it can be a bit daunting and difficult to know what to do. And hopefully in this book, I provide some, at least the right questions to ask. And then parents can make their own decisions.
There was a lovely story you tell in the book about modelling the respectful, constructive approach to the school community that your mum gave you. And it sounds like it was a bit of a hard lesson for you at the time with your failure to pull up your socks.
Well, yeah, I was a little bit of a troublemaking young child in primary school. And this story happened when I was in year six. I'd had a big falling out with my teacher, and we had not got on well at all. And I stormed home at lunchtime over something. And I thought when I got home, my mother would hear my side of the story and think, yes, Adrian, you're perfectly right. I'll march up to school with you and tell those teachers that you're in the right. And I was absolutely wrong, because she marched me up to school, insisted that the detention be doubled and various other punishments, and sent me off. But what she told me 10 years later was that she then sat down with the principal and the teacher and said, look, we need to work this out. And she tried to work it out behind the scenes, without undermining the school to me. She could have said to me, oh, the teacher doesn't know what they're talking about, I'll sort this out, and you're right, darling. And that would have just absolutely sent me the wrong message. So the point of that story is, parents have the right to be cranky about things when they go wrong in schools, or if there's something the teacher's doing or the school's doing. They're within their rights to deal with that. But go up, have a constructive conversation with teachers and principals, and even if the doesn't get sorted out, there are higher levels you can go to, but start with where the problem is and then work your way through that, but in a constructive way. Make an appointment. Don't storm up there and insist that everybody drop everything to deal with your particular problem. But try not to undermine your school's authority in front of your children, because they do need to respect teachers and they do need to respect their school.
And I love how you talk in a broader way too about ways to model coping with disappointment. And I was quailed a little bit. Oh, we're not meant to shout at the TV when Australia drops a catch, for example. It's about what happens in the home, isn't it? Not just your attitudes directly towards the school.
And this is, again, an important thing around the behaviour and the conduct that you model as a parent. So how do you handle stress and disappointment at home? And, you know, modern life is stressful and difficult, financial stresses, relationship stresses. How do you deal with that at home? Because your children are watching you, even if they're not directly looking at you, they're observing how you handle disappointment and stress, and they're likely to take messages from that. So I think that's really important. And even this issue about failure at school or disappointment or stress at school, I'm not a believer in removing all stress from school. Life is stressful, and the sooner you get used to it, the better. I mean, without overdoing it, of course, at school. But if there's one place where you get a second, third, fourth, and tenth chance, is at school. So disappointment, failure at school, you usually get another chance. That's the place to learn. That's not the place to stop disappointment or stop these opportunities to fail. But it's actually really where you've got to learn to do it. And, you know, teachers will often say, you know, parents are anxious about their children's disappointment at school and they want to minimise it. Well, it's actually where it should happen, because teachers are there to support children, and that's as I say, there are opportunities to recover from that at school. Some of those opportunities don't apply when you're a grown-up and you're an adult.
Well, you talk also about push targets and stretch targets and personal bests. Can you tell us what they are?
So the University of New South Wales, Professor Andrew Martin's done some great research around personal bests as a way to motivate children. So rather than looking at, you know, are they coming first? Are they coming last? It's more about, okay, where's your child at and motivating them to do their personal best. And that applies to basically the performance of any child. So even if the child is the highest performing child in the school, motivating them to actually improve on their own personal best performance, the same as they do in sport. has proved through that research to be a very effective way of motivating students. I talk a bit about that in the book, but I think this thing about expectations is really important. You know, I think you can do really well in your exam, or I think you can do really well in that soccer game if you work hard, if you listen, if you sit down, if you commit the time, if you do the training. Again, the research will say you motivate children and students by telling them what they need to do in order to get that result, not just the fact, hey, you're really clever, that's why you're going to do really well. Because they can't really control how innately clever they are.
And also it doesn't break it down into steps, does it? It doesn't tell them what being clever is.
That's exactly right. And you can't control that, but you can control the amount of effort. You can control how much you listen, how much you concentrate. So if you don't get quite the result, you can then break that down. Could I have done anything differently? Could I have spent more time doing it? Could I have done more training? Could we have? So I think those are important things about motivating students, setting expectations without creating stress if you don't get there and a sense of failure and disappointment.
And I love that you talk about the power of positive expectations, but I'm also wondering how far they can counteract the negative expectations. And I'm just interested in a new discussion paper by the Centre for Policy Development that's talking about high achievers being increasingly concentrated in advantage schools,
yep,
and the opposite in lower socioeconomic status schools. So they're really being left behind. And I'm wondering, that obviously entrenches a set of low expectations of some schools and higher expectations of other schools. How do we as a community deal with that?
To deal with that is a challenging problem, because you have to change the structure of schools. So, you know, the fact that schools charge fees, very high fees, are going to be predominantly filled with children from those higher income families who've gone on to further study. It's going to concentrate that. Even selective schools, I come from New South Wales. Yeah, you're concentrating high ability students into the one schools. A school. This again is one of the problems I have with NAPLAN and the My School website. Parents can make the wrong decisions about schools based on those results. So if a school's got more green when you go on the My School website, there's a perception that that's a better school, and that's not necessarily the case. They might actually just have more students who are of a higher SES family background. It doesn't actually have any impact on how your individual child will do at that school. So to change how we fund schools or charging fees, how we change selective schools, I mean, there are very entrenched issues, and not even that government has a reluctance to do it, but parents would push back significantly on that. But it is causing a social problem in Australia, this residualisation of some schools, not just in big cities, but in country areas as well.
Well, and we're seeing much more disadvantage in country areas, according to that report, but also just people moving suburbs to get to the good, what is perceived as the good state schools, non-government schools too. So as you
well,
say,
and this is this perception issue, and I just don't think that's right. And my great criticism of NAPLAN and the My School website is it creates this perception that is often wrong. I mean, I can't believe that, say, in inner city Melbourne, where there's one school that's in high demand and three blocks away, there's another public school that's not in such demand. I can't imagine that the teaching workforce across those two schools is much different, the principal's much different, they're teaching the same curriculum. It's just a perception issue. And that perception then drives more enrolments into a particular school and in fact, reinforcing that perception. So we could talk about this all day.
Exactly.
There are some of these profound problems, and there's a whole chapter in there about actually how to interpret NAPLAN correctly from a parent's perspective and how to use the information you get in your report to support your child's education. So there's a whole chapter about handling that correctly.
Well, and people are very keenly aware at the moment, I guess, of the pressures that can affect a child's mental health if the expectations are placed on them in the way that's not appropriate for them. How do you have high expectations of your child's learning potential, but do that helpfully and constructively and supportively?
Again, the emphasis should be on praising the effort, not more than the outcome. Of course, we'll praise the outcome, but the effort, irrespective of the result. You know, if your children, I say this to my children as well, I expect you to put in as much effort as possible. Like, you know, I expect you to be able to, or to concentrate, to listen. And if you do that to the best of your abilities, then whatever result you get, then I'm going to be happy with. So that's different to if you don't get 95% in that exam, I'm going to be really angry. But I also
that doesn't sound helpful at all.
I also think sometimes parents inadvertently put pressure on children. Accidentally, I don't think any parent deliberately tries to put pressure on their children. But they do. I think as parents, we've got to look at ourselves and are we actually letting our children be themselves, or are our expectations of them actually a bit of a reflection about what we want them to look like, or we want them to be, or how we want them to perform? Sometimes I think we accidentally put that pressure on them.
So just quickly before we finish, Professor Adrian Piccoli, what's your view on screens in the home and in school?
Keep them out of bedrooms. Sleep is a big problem in schools. More schools are saying kids are coming with not enough rest. Keep them out of bedrooms. Restrict their time. There are recommendations from the Department of Health about time, 0 for 0 to 2, 2 hours from 2 to 5, no more than 2 hours, and then 2 hours
per day
from from the age of 5 to 17. And keep to those time limits. The research around the world is saying this is a growing problem, and we know, I think every parent knows it's a problem. And the other thing I would just say is a lot of social media sites have age limits. So do games like Fortnite. Fortnite, you're not supposed to use it until you're 12, and let's just abide by those age limits.
Follow the rules, guys. Thank you so much for coming on the program today.
That's my pleasure.
Professor Adrian Piccoli, Director of the Gonski Institute of Education, former New South Wales Minister of Education, and author of 12 Ways Your Child Can Get the Best Out of School. You're on Life Matters with me, Hilary Harper. And Michael McKenzie is with us next to hear some responses from you across the show.